This is the BBC third programme. In our series America Since the Bomb, we're now broadcasting The Spy Scare by Alastair Cook. America's discovery of the secret of the atomic bomb in 1945 brought with it new fears for national security, which were not lessened by Russia's successful testing of her own bomb 4 years later. Alastair Cook explains how the trial of Alger Hiss in 1949-50 and the subsequent emergence of McCarthyism reflected these fears. The spy scare.
There is a problem, and for a working newspaperman a fascinating one, in recalling those people and events that fell within his own experience and which historians have already dignified with the name of a period or an era. Historians can do this with confidence because they are experts at picking two significant dates and enclosing within them an historical experience. I've noticed that the closer they are to the chosen period, the more wary they tend to be, and rightly, because they are then relapsing from their sanctuary of time and distance into the plight of the newspaperman, who must report history on the wing and who, in the great sky above him, is lucky to distinguish the swoop of an eagle from the fall of a sparrow. It may well be that schoolboys, in European countries especially, are already learning the dates of the McCarthy era. Now, the fall of Constantinople is a compulsory date to schoolboys, and because all the medieval histories that I read as a boy ended with a bang at 1453, I always imagined that in 1454, people woke up, as from a nightmare, decided to have some sane, modern history, and deliberately started a chain of events that led to the establishment of the Church of England, trial by jury, the invention of the steam engine, the Impressionists, and the supermarket. But I wonder if the people who were in their 20s, say, in 1453, had much awareness that they had turned an historical corner and that the Middle Ages, which they probably knew only as life itself, were over. So when I hear young people toss off the word McCarthyism with the implication that McCarthy was as monstrous as Judge Jeffreys and that all sensible people knew it at the time, I'm bound to recall the grip that he held on millions of otherwise sensible Americans, and also the long argument over whether Eisenhower, in publicly ignoring him, was wisely letting him run out of steam over the long pull, or whether Eisenhower was, like a giant Andrew Johnson, so ignorant about the reserves of power that a president must call on when he's under extreme attack by the legislative branch, that he very nearly ceased to be President of the United States and declined into le Président de la République, which is an imposing shell of an office in the French system, but an impossible abdication of the American system. McCarthy, it's convenient to say, was the symbol and the apotheosis of the spy scare that overtook America in the late 1940s and the early 1950s. The phrase spy scare is dangerously neat. The revelation of actual spies, Nunn May, Klaus Fuchs, Burgess and Maclean, could have been a coincidence, but it was more probably a confirmation of the general dismay in America that ran riot for a time, the fear that all the misfortunes of the Cold War, the intransigence of the Soviet Union, and the loss of China to the communists were due not to the turn of history, to scientific knowledge widely shared, or to forces beyond our control, but to the treachery of Americans in high and low office. I'm going to string together some dates which, at the time, appeared as a series of storm signals sent up by the communist world. By listing these dates together, of course, I'm running the historian's occupational risk, the strong suggestion that history is a series of post hoc, propter hoc propositions. It is important, with the series I'm going to quote to appreciate how close together these various calamities came, so that in the mind of a nation disposed to believe that life is manageable and happenstance is atypical, they did indeed carry with them the alarmed belief that what happened after one event happened because of it. In February 1948, Czechoslovakia succumbed to a communist ultimatum to install a pro-Soviet cabinet. 2 weeks later, Jan Masaryk, the son of the Republic's founder and foreign minister at the time, committed suicide. This was an immense shock to Americans who had a special affection for Czechoslovakia. Woodrow Wilson was always thought of as the godfather of the new nation, and Jan Masaryk was respected, if not believed, more than any other statesman would have been, when he used to say that the Cold War was a fantasy and that the Russians had no sinister designs on the independence of their neighbors. I think that the suicide of Masaryk was the third and most telling stage in the slow but sure American revulsion towards the Soviet Union, the first having been the state trials of the 1930s, the second the signing of the Nazi-Soviet Pact in 1939. Masaryk's death confirmed the post-war fear that Russia was building an empire of her own by a ruthless combination of the techniques of the old British trader and the new Nazi techniques of the stormtrooper and the Gestapo. It directly prompted Truman and his administration, not the Republicans, to begin the systematic investigation of the loyalty of government employees. It actually reversed the opposition of very many senators to the pending Marshall Plan and guaranteed the swift passage of the European Recovery Program, the forerunner of the United States' vast disbursement of foreign economic and military aid. It is not possible now, looking back on it, to exaggerate the shock of Masaryk's suicide. For our purpose, which is to look again at the most traumatic episode of the spy scare, it significantly tightened the net which was to close in 6 months later on Alger Hiss. 4. A month after the collapse of Czechoslovakia's independence, the House of Representatives gave a blood transfusion to the weak and wobbling House Un-American Activities Committee by voting a record $200,000 for it to stay on the trail of domestic communists. Now, the committee had not been having much luck with its search for communists inside the government, but flushed now with its record appropriation, it peered into the National Bureau of Standards, which passes on the claims of everything from radiation research to a grosser scales, and dared to say that its director was one of the weakest links in our atomic security. The director invited a full investigation by the government, and he was unreservedly cleared by the FBI, the Department of Commerce, and the Atomic Energy Commission. Well, the committee looked foolish, not to say inept, except to itself. It had an army of investigators, some of them former FBI agents, and by the spring of 1948, it had collected a private file of police records, Communist Party membership lists, surrendered letters, and the like, which convinced the congressmen on the committee that just before the Second War, long before the Soviet Union was an active ally, there had been enough organized espionage inside the government to astound the country and throw back in President Truman's face his constant jeers at the committee's seeming paranoia. By the way, it's never been made clear how close the committee's investigators are or were to the FBI and its agents, but it's worth a passing thought that in the summer of 1948, when the committee was about to strike pay dirt, it is likely that the FBI were looking for Klaus Fuchs and had been tipped off about the suspicious activities of Burgess and Maclean. At any rate, the FBI surely was not as thunderstruck as the rest of us when, just a year later, the American nuclear monopoly was ended by the explosion of the first Russian atomic bomb. By that time, Alger Hiss had survived his first trial with a hung jury and was about to come to his second. I mention this because during and after the second trial, there were other alarms from the outside world, the proclamation, for instance, of the People's Republic of China, and concurrent shocks from within, like the trial and conviction of the 11 leaders of the American Communist Party. That threw a fog of sinister association around the Hiss trial and made its victim appear to be a particularly modern and guileful sort of traitor. All the more so because he was a cultivated Ivy League type, self-possessed to the point of mild irritation and fatigue before the grossness of his accusers. Well, now to that hot, almost fetid summer of 1948. The ominous date in the apparently favored life of Alger Hiss was the 2nd of August, when a certain Stephen Birmingham walked into the New York office of Time magazine to serve a subpoena from the House Un-American Activities Committee on one David Whittaker Chambers, a senior editor. Mr. Chambers, a portly, middle-aged man with an air of unruffled resignation, was summoned to appear before the committee and say what he knew, as a repentant communist, about communist espionage in the government. Chambers had good reason to seem resigned. He'd tried, immediately after the signing of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, and for 9 years thereafter, to tell his story to various government departments, and he'd been brushed off. On the 3rd of August, 1948, he appeared in Washington in a public session of the committee, frankly allowed he had been a paid officer of the Communist Party for 13 years, till he quit the party in 1937. Then he named the names of 7 men who, he said, had formed a communist apparatus in or near the government.
The head of the underground group at the time I knew it was Nathan Witt, an attorney of the National Labor Relations Board. Later, John App became the leader. Lee Pressman was also a member of this group, as was Alger Hiss, who was a member of the State Department, later organized the conferences at Dumbarton Oaks, San Francisco, and the U.S. side of the Yalta Conference. The purpose of this group at that time was not primarily espionage. Its original purpose was the communist infiltration of the American government, but espionage was certainly one of its eventual objectives.
The one name that electrified the committee was that of Alger Hiss. He'd been, in the 1930s, a State Department officer just below the first rank. He'd been a junior aide of President Roosevelt at the Yalta Conference, which the Republicans had long maintained was the occasion of a sellout to Stalin. He had been the secretary organizer of the United Nations founding conference at San Francisco. And at all the plenary sessions, I well remember how he sat alone above the statesman speakers like Jove. Here was the catch that the Republicans, if not the committee, had been longing for. It's now perhaps irrelevant to point out that Hiss was never a policymaker, and not much more than a clerk at Yalta. He was transmuted by the committee's need and the public's suspicions into a fallen angel of Roosevelt's New Deal. The 6 other men accused lay low, but when Hiss heard that night about Chambers' accusation, he asked to come before the committee at once and deny it. 2 days later, he appeared.
My name is Alger Hiss. I am here at my own request to deny unqualifiedly various statements about me which were made before this committee by one Whittaker Chambers, day before yesterday. I am not and never have been a member of the Communist Party. To the best of my knowledge, I never heard of Whittaker Chambers until in 1947, when two representatives of the Federal Bureau of Investigation asked me if I knew him and various other people, I said I did not know Chambers. So far as I am aware, I have never laid eyes on him, and I should like to have the opportunity to do so.
Hiss's first appearance was so impressive that the committee called Chambers back 2 days later in a private session to see if he hadn't made a howling error of identity. Chambers was quite unmoved by the committee's alarm and then disclosed an astonishingly intimate knowledge of Hiss, his wife, family, and various dwelling places. The committee confessed to bewilderment. It brought Hiss in again, this time in private too, and Hiss planted the first seed of doubt by recalling the name of a vagrant journalist who at one period had spent time in his house and sublet an apartment. Some days later, the committee decided to confront Hiss with Chambers. It brought them to a New York hotel room, and in a private session, bristling with ill will all around, Hiss thought aloud, but not for sure, that the portly man sitting opposite might be the vagrant journalist, one George Crossley. Chambers said he was not George Crossley and had never heard the name. Chambers coolly maintained that he was accusing none other than the slim man opposite, Alger Hiss, known to him for years as a communist. Hiss lividly dared Chambers to repeat his accusation outside the legal protection of a congressional hearing. For the time being, it was arranged that the two should confront each other in a public session, which came on the 25th of August, on a day of infernal heat, before a packed and dripping audience and the eye of the television cameras. Now, here are three actual passages from the hearings. First, Whitaker Chambers.
You were very fond of Mr. Hiss?
Indeed, I was. He was perhaps my closest friend. Certainly the closest friend I ever had in the Communist Party.
Now, here is the public confrontation.
Mr. Hiss, would you kindly stand up, please? Mr. Chambers, would you stand up? Mr. Hiss, have you ever seen this individual who is standing?
I have.
Do you know him?
I identify him,
Mr. Hiss. As who?
As George Crosby.
And here is Hiss's categorical denial.
Except, as I have indicated, the statements about me made by Mr. Chambers are complete fabrications. I think my record in the government service speaks for itself.
Well, after this scene, this was obviously the trial of the century. It was not yet, of course, a trial. But the freewheeling procedure of a congressional committee, especially when seen over television, conveys to a viewer the concentration of melodrama that you get from a trial recreated in the movies. Hiss began to retreat into the legal protection of phrases like, according to my best or my then recollection. Chambers was immovable in his accusations and elaborated them with ease and alarming conviction. 2 nights later, he repeated them, as Hiss had dared him, on a national radio program, and Hiss accordingly brought suit for defamation. Hiss was either innocent and quixotic, or guilty and uncommonly brazen. Whichever it was, he invited his own trial and his doom. The charge was a simple one. Chambers maintained that Hiss, while he was in the State Department, had pilfered confidential state documents and given them to him, Chambers, for use by the communists. Hiss denied it all. Later, Chambers produced 2 wads of documents, one hidden in the house of an old friend, another hidden in a pumpkin on the Chambers farm in Maryland. These disclosures were so bizarre, the plot was thickening in such a spooky way, that naturally the press had a field day. And when Hiss came to trial, he was highly suspect, and Chambers was either a black villain or a martyr. 4. Chambers had the gall to say that these hidden documents were typewritten copies of the state papers Hiss had stolen and given to him 10 years or more ago. The fatal moments for Hiss, I think, were the discovery by State Department experts that they were indeed typed copies of documents that Hiss had had access to, and the charge of the FBI's typewriter experts that the typing had been done by a typewriter that the Hisses once owned. Hiss never broke down, but his credibility gave out fast when he came to admit both these facts. Hiss had now to prove that somehow Chambers stole the typewriter, at a time when he was supposed never to have known him, and done the typing himself, or that between his accusation of Hiss and the disclosure of the documents, Chambers had actually constructed a typewriter, meticulously contrived the same defects of typeface, spacing, and so on, and therefore achieved a masterpiece of forgery by typewriter. Well, it could never be proved. In the first trial, the jury was divided and was discharged on a slip by the government's prosecutor, who was willing to admit the defense lawyer's contention that, if you don't believe Whittaker Chambers, the government has no case. Four of the jurors did not believe him, and a second trial was called. Everything we'd heard before, we heard again, and Chambers was, if anything, more relaxed and confident in his recital of circumstantial evidence which, I should guess, would have convicted Hiss in any British or American court, excepting only a Scottish one, where he might have been lucky enough to earn a verdict of not proven. The defense could never persuade the jury that Chambers had, by any sort of ingenuity, managed to steal the Hiss typewriter and type all the documents in secret, and in the subsequent appeal, the judge was never convinced that Chambers had the time and the phenomenal mechanical skill required to manufacture a typewriter or transform one that could deceive lifelong experts by reproducing the exact physical peculiarities of the old Hiss machine. The United States Supreme Court upheld the conviction, and Hiss went to jail. When he came out, he got various jobs, sold things from house to house. He was a girdle salesman, and he's gone into oblivion. We used to say that everything would be made clear if one of the principals in the case died, or either couple got a divorce. Well, both Chambers and Mrs. Chambers are dead, and the Hisses are divorced. We know no more and no less. What, the learned listener is now going to ask, has historical perspective brought to this case and to the period of the spy scare which merged with and overlapped the McCarthy era? First of all, I should ask in reply, when do we know that historical perspective has set in? Do we know more or less about the origins of the First World War 50 years later than 10 years later? Is the political reputation of Lloyd George now in permanent focus 44 years after his fall, or of Paul Reynaud just after his death? What is the proof that Hemingway will be read avidly again in 20 years or 100? Why was John Donne practically unknown to the Victorians and a beacon to students in the 1930s and still in the 1960s? These are not frivolous questions, and they are the ones that must be faced by any serious pilot who would stay for an answer. 30 years of reporting America at least, have inclined me to a pendulum view of history, if we limit our scrutiny to any single society. The mothers of upper-class Victorians, who themselves would have blushed to refer to the legs of a piano, were Regency ladies who contrived to show their nipples in the Empire ball gowns of the period. I believe that within a year or two at most, the miniskirt will be banished in favor of skirts to the ankle or just above. The LSD beatnik will be succeeded by a new Puritanism. And it may be, I fear, that the present temper of the United States, which is that of a country so reckless in its passion for liberty that it's almost drunk on it, Will, from fright at the racial and other demons it has let loose, react with a discipline imposed from outside, a discipline as witless and brutal as that of McCarthy, who had a very simple logic. A, a communist, disapproves of B and does not disapprove of C. Therefore, C is a communist. I bring up McCarthy because he follows naturally and inevitably from the conviction of Alger Hiss. It does not follow, as some impatient liberals would have you believe, that therefore Hiss was innocent. This is a reaction, though of a rebel kind, inside the school of McCarthy's own logic. Hiss was, in all probability, guilty as charged of perjury, only because the legal statute of limitations on espionage had run out. If there had not been Hiss, there would have been Judith Copland or William Remington, two other employees of the government, the one convicted of espionage, the other of perjury. But the case of Alger Hiss was uniquely fascinating. The accusation was outrageous, but proved to the satisfaction of all but four of 24 jurymen. It had the elements of a whodunit, of the Dreyfus case, of Conrad's Under Western Eyes, of Koestler and Kafka. To the people at large, it presented something of the titillation that the novels of Charles Garvis and Charles Morgan used to hold for humble servants. In their case, it was the tasty sensation of adultery above stairs. In the Hiss case, it was the terrifying novelty of a spy with a Harvard accent. The subsequent inquisition was nothing new in American history, but the Hiss case prompted, or perhaps only exposed, a menacing variation of it. Whereas in the past, during the Alien and Sedition Acts of the late 1790s, and also the notorious raids on private houses of Woodrow Wilson's Attorney General, the aim was to identify treason with resident foreigners. The Hiss case released the impulse of thoroughly acclimatized immigrants, and Irish Catholics were only the most noticeable, to rise against their old superiors and find treason in the Eastern establishment. At any rate, the verdict galvanized the country into a bitter realization of the Native American types who might be dedicated to betrayal from within. It ushered in a period when a high premium would be put on the chameleon and the politically neutral slob. It gave to ambitious politicians a license to use vigilance as a political weapon merely. To one politician in particular. 2 weeks after Hiss was sentenced to jail, an obscure senator from Wisconsin made a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, proclaiming that to his certain knowledge there were 57 communists in the State Department. From that moment on, the junior senator from Wisconsin, catapulted out of obscurity by a preposterous boast, was never out of the headlines until the day, almost 5 years later, when he did not so much outrage the people as bore the Senate. But that is another story, or perhaps the historians will say another chapter of the same story.
That was The Spy Scare by Alistair Cook, produced by D.G. Brideson.